Now, in this case, we have an appeal, and we have a cross appeal, and then two more cross appeals. And I understand that you've all asked for the time you want to reserve, and we set the clock accordingly. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well.
Justice Holland, Justice Jacobs, and Justice Ridgely, good afternoon. I'd just like to introduce Amy Quinlan, who's seated with me, so that you know who's seated with me. This is a medical negligence case that was filed back in 2005. It was tried to a jury verdict in 2007, and I represent Christiana Care. Mr. Zappa represents the plaintiffs, and Mr. Elzafan represents the co-defendant Family Practice Associates and Dr. Connor. Following the jury verdict, we filed a motion for new trial. The motion for new trial was denied by Judge Cooch, who was the trial judge, and this is the appeal. The primary issue that I want to bring before the court is the issue of leading questions. During the trial, as indicated in my brief, the trial judge permitted leading questions as a matter of right to experts throughout the trial. Initially, when there was leading questions, there was objection made. I was the trial attorney at the time for Christiana Care. I made the objections, and the rulings were that this was an expert and that leading questions were permissible.
Now, in your brief, you've indicated that the standard of review for this claim is abuse of discretion, which seems to acknowledge that the judge could appropriately permit some leading questions. Your contention is, that you permitted 2 minutes?
Yes, that there could be no objection to any question based on leading if it was an expert, regardless of whether it was slightly leading or whether it was grossly leading, whether it was on a critical issue or whether it was on just foundation, because I had objected on two or three occasions initially. I was told the ruling was not that it was leading or not leading. The ruling was this is an expert and leading questions are permissible.
So the reason I asked about the standard of review based on your characterization of the ruling, it seems that the judge said almost as a matter of law, leading questions are permitted of expert witnesses, rather than, I understand this is something I can do in my discretion, and I want you to know I'm exercising my discretion to permit it throughout the trial.
That is correct, and that's the fundamental basic difference of exercising discretion and not exercising any discretion when making decisions with regard to whether a question is leading or not. After I was told, or after the rulings came down that I could not ask leading questions, or leading questions could be asked of experts, I asked for a sidebar and said that I can't make any further objections because as long as an expert is on the witness stand, I can't stand up because if I keep doing that, I'm going to prejudice my client because the trial judge is simply going to say it's an expert. And how many times can I stand up before and be told the same thing? So I was effectively, I thought, shut off from using my right to object to leading questions.
Is it correct that each of the experts testified in conformity with their prior depositions and their prior reports?
Well, to a great extent, Your Honor, I would have to agree with that. But the rules of evidence, of course, are different than when we're taking depositions or when we're looking at reports. And it's always not exactly the same thing, and there are always things that come up at trial that are slightly different. It's certainly not identical, and we have different sets of rules that apply to each. So I had asked the trial court if I could have a continuing objection because I didn't want to just keep standing up knowing that an expert was on the witness stand, and the judge said I could have a continuing objection, and then I did not object any further to leading questions.
Mr. Ferry, excuse me.
Yes, Your Honor.
If I understand the essential thrust of your argument, it's that while the trial court in its discretion can permit leading questions of experts, there still must nonetheless be an exercise of discretion. Here, there was a blank check, therefore discretion wasn't exercised. If that's true,
yes,
then presumably we would have to conclude that, that there was an abuse of discretion. But the analysis would have to go on and inquires to whether that was whether the abuse was so prejudicial as to require a new trial. Can you address that?
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. That is the second step that you would have to analyze. And I have set out the specifics in the brief. We discussed because the leading questions go to opinions that were given by the experts, critical opinions on standard of care and causation. They were not just to the foundation, which we all agree that, you know, that's permissible. I've tried to, since leading questions were permissible, there were quite a number of witnesses called in the case, and leading questions were permitted, and I can give, there are examples, and I can go through some of the examples if the court would like me to do that.
It might be helpful to us if you could articulate the prejudice or the nature of the prejudice in some general terms. Because it's, you know, under one scenario, even though the court should not have, in a sense, declined to exercise its discretion in policing how expert witnesses were questioned, it could well be that it doesn't matter because the experts simply testified in accordance with their pretrial disclosures.
Yeah, well,
no surprises.
Your Honor, I can give you a general basis for that, and that is the rule of evidence 611, which says that leading questions should not be permitted. And because the basis for the rule itself is that we want to get to the truth. And the rule that is set forth about not using leading questions, unless there are certain circumstances, such as cross-examination or children or incompetence, is that that is the best way to go through a trial to ascertain the truth. And this court in the Cahill case, when looking at whether or not a trial judge in that case was exercising his duties properly, said that, you know, the obligation is to make prompt and rulings when attorneys make objections, not to cut off those objections. And what happens if you early in the case, if you give a green light or a blank check, then the case then turns into nothing but leading questions.
I'm asking you to articulate the prejudice. Is the prejudice the potential that those leading questions can bend or distort the truth? Or is the prejudice that they actually did in specific cases? And if it's the latter, then what situations or what circumstances was that done?
Well, I think it's impossible to, in a sense, tell you that there is a prejudice because you don't know that, and you can't know that. I think all the court can do is to look at how pervasive the leading questions were, and they started at the very beginning and they went all the way through till the end, and there was no discretion exercised. So I think under those circumstances, the way that the case was presented to the jury would not be in the way that was envisioned by the rule. And I don't know that there could ever be anybody that can point out to you where the specific prejudice would be. But if you allow numerous...
Are you arguing that there's prejudice per se?
Well, I'm arguing that there's prejudice because of the way in which the case was presented to the jury in the form of leading questions when, for example, a summary is given to the witness and the statement is, well, do you agree that that was a breach of standard of care? And then the expert says yes, as opposed to giving a narrative answer, which an expert is supposed to do and educate the jury. It should be the expert speaking and enlightening the jury, not parroting, not the attorney testifying and then having the witness.
I understand you correctly, you're arguing, and tell me if I've got this right or wrong, that because of the way the questions were framed, that the presentation to the jury crossed the line between being simply exposition and argument, and it basically took the form of argument during the testimony.
Well, it basically took argument, and it basically gave the jury no opportunity to evaluate what the experts are saying and to evaluate the knowledge and preparation of the expert, because the attorney would sum it up and the expert would simply say yes or no.
Well, if the expert says yes or no, let's assume he says yes, that incorporates whatever the question is into his answer. So the jury can evaluate that, can it not?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I think the jury and the truth-finding process is totally hampered if the attorney is the one that's testifying and the expert simply acknowledges, as opposed to the expert displaying what expertise that he has that enables him to come to those conclusions. And, I think that's the reason for the rule. Otherwise, the rule would be crafted otherwise, that friendly witnesses, you could use, any manner of questioning. But to use friendly experts and friendly witnesses and to lead is something that I think taints the fact-finding process, and the jury is not presented with that ability to evaluate those experts.
One of the cases that you cited, Green versus United States, a D.C. Circuit case, which says discretion permitting leading questions must be exercised with great caution to avoid the evil of supplying a false memory for the witness. Now, can you tell us in any instance where you can make that charge that happened in this
case? Sure. I can. In the testimony of Nurse Hirsch, for example, she was not, in my judgment, she was not a very prepared witness and needed and was not going to be able to display any articulation to the jury without being led. This was obvious in her deposition. You had asked about deposition before. This was obvious in her deposition, and when it came time from trial, she was led, and that's how her testimony was presented to the jury.
Can you give us a cite to the record where this false memory was provided?
I believe I can. I'd like to. My time is running out.
You still have 40 seconds of the 3 minutes you reserved, but the court will give you a couple of minutes. Before you sit down, however, okay, you haven't addressed the second issue you raised in your brief, which is the challenge to the closing argument by Dr. O'Connor's attorney.
Yes.
And it's my understanding from the record that there were no objections, and therefore the standard of review would be plain error. Is that right? There were no objections?
I did not make an objection at the time, and I admittedly could have, but I think it is something that in conjunction with the other issue that I've argued.
But the standard of review would be plain error in the absence of an objection.
I agree.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, and I also welcome the Richard Rodney Inn. I'm an appellant on one issue, the Dr. Pullen issue, and an appellee on two issues, my remarks in closing and the prejudgment interest, and I'm going to take them seriatim. On the issue of Dr. Pullen, he was asked to give a causation opinion going back to 10 o'clock in the morning. The standard of care that applied to my client, Mary Ann Connor, was, by both plaintiff's experts, she was required to have ordered the CAT scan on a stat basis by 11:15 a.m. As long as it was done by that, she met the standard of care. That was deposition testimony confirmed during trial. When Dr. Pullen was asked to give in a causation opinion as to whether the CAT scan early would have made a difference, he did not link it to 11:15 in the morning. He linked it to 10 a.m. That was prejudicial. That's a specific instance of prejudice because
the testimony itself is prejudicial, or in addition to the testimony, there was argument to the jury with regard to 10 a.m. rather than 11:15.
It was both, because as I saw it and I argued in my brief, the jury is being told all along 11:15, 11:15, 11:15, and then all of a sudden they're asked to do causation back to 10 a.m., and in the jury's mind, that could draw a conclusion, well, maybe Mary Ann Connor should have done it by 10 a.m., and clearly she did not order that CAT scan by 10 a.m. That was undisputed, and we thought it was confusing to the jury and prejudicial because it injected into the case a standard of care element which was never there. It was standard of care through the...
Your contention is it was an error of law to permit this at trial because that opinion had not been disclosed ahead of time.
True, but especially in the context of how it came up, because by linking the two together at trial, it mixed apples and oranges. Dr. Poland was not a standard of care expert, and he acknowledged it, but he injected a standard of care through the back door of 10 a.m., which was never argued by the plaintiffs. If I may change gears and go to the prejudgment interest argument, which I'm an appellee. Judge Cooch was correct here. The statute does not contemplate, I think, joint and several. The intent of the statute is if a defendant can settle a case for less than the amount of the verdict, there should be a financial consequence. The settlement demand here was 1.25 for each defendant for a total of 2.5. The jury was $2 million total. The demand against my client was 1.25. The verdict was 800,000. So in both cases, while my client might have been quote-unquote wrong in deciding whether they would win or lose, my client was correct in its evaluation of the case. The verdict was less than the demand.
I understand, Mr. Elsifon, that the term of the statute that triggers its application is judgment, not verdict. And if that is true, isn't it correct that the judgment in these cases that was entered against both defendants was $2 million?
That is a correct fact. But the statute is ambiguous in terms of when you have joint defendants, and if the intention of the – you could have a situation, Your Honor, if that's the case, where a defendant who is 1% liable – could be completely correct in their evaluation, finds themselves paying prejudgment interest on a huge amount. And I think you have to look at what this statute is trying to foster.
Well, how does the apportionment of fault relate to the amount of the judgment if they're both jointly and severally liable for $2 million?
I don't think the statute addresses that. I think that's what the court has to deal with. That's why I think we have to go to the intent. In this particular case, the defendants both correctly evaluated whether if they lost, it would be borne more or less what the plaintiff demanded.
Well, isn't this language rather straightforward? Claim which was less than the amount of damages upon which the judgment was entered. Isn't that...
That is the language of the statute, but I don't think, but I suggest to the court respectfully that in the situation of joint tortfeasors, the statute does not address it, and therefore the court should interpret, and I think the court should go to the intent.
How would it work if one defendant had the ability to pay the entire judgment and the other defendant had no money at all? Would your argument still be the same?
Yes. It would be.
If your analysis is correct, that is, if the statute is ambiguous, that is, the word term judgment is ambiguous, that would mean, presumably, that we would have to construe the statute based on some extrinsic consideration.
I think you should sorry to interrupt.
My question is, what if we were to do that and have to write an opinion telling the world what judgment means, what would it say? What would the opinion say?
I would lobby for the proposition that the court would look, when you are going beyond the quote, language itself, to what is the statute trying to obtain? What's the purpose of it? What's the financial consequence to a defendant is you could have settled for less than what you were, the judgment was entered against you, or the amount of it.
At the end of the day, we have to rule.
Yes, you do.
What the word judgment means.
In this case, I would say the judgment as to that particular defendant.
I'm sorry.
The judgment as to that particular defendant. My client and Mr. Ferry's client in the position of evaluating correctly what this case would come down on if they took it to trial and quote-unquote lost, which they did.
But aren't you really arguing that the word judgment has to read judgment, parenthesis, including an allocation of fault?
Yes. And in the 41 seconds that I have left, on the issue of the remarks that I made, one, they were not wrong. I never said this. I believe this person is not telling the truth. I believe. Two, there was a waiver by not raising it at the time. Mr. Ferry did follow me. There was a jury instruction afterward that I could be disregarded. And in point of fact, on the issue that this argument was made, which is it being challenged, the jury did disregard what I had to say because I lost that argument. So well, not it was plain error. It didn't
it
matter.
It wasn't as much a waiver as being subject to review only for plain error. Is that right?
Both, I think. May I? Because this has stopped. I think in the Lockheed opinion, which Judge Cooch cited, it talked about waiver and is also a plain error. So it goes both ways.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Ms. Apper, good afternoon.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the plaintiff below, appellee, the Harris family, who were also the cross appellants on the ruling of the trial court that prejudgment interest is not appropriate under the circumstances of this case. I'd like to start with the prejudgment interest statute since I have no rebuttal, and I want to make sure I do cover that. Our position is the only error committed by the trial judge came after the trial when the court denied prejudgment interest under 43 or 2301D of Title VI. The trial court erroneously concluded that the statute did not specifically address the situation involving a defendant whose liability might in fact later turn out to be joint and several with another tortfeasor, and that allowed the court to judicially interpret the statute. And in so doing, we say impermissibly interpreted an unambiguous statute and carved out an exception which was never intended by the legislature. This court's rulings as
can,
to
can
statute.
Can you tell me, with regard to this legislative history, is this based on a uniform state law or patterned after any other state, or was this invented by the Delaware General Assembly with assistance?
I cannot answer the question about whether it's a uniform. It is a fairly recent addition. It was done principally by the, I think both sides. It was by mutual submission by the plaintiff's bar and the defense bar, but primarily the plaintiff's bar to level the playing field because the offer of judgment rule was defense-oriented, whereas there was no comparable penalty exacted from a defendant who simply declines to negotiate in good faith and accept settlement proposals in writing. So I can't speak to the issue of whether it's a uniform or a model statute. I can only speak to the issue of why it was done. It was done to have a counterbalancing on the question of settlement.
So it's unique as far as you know? Then?
As far as I know. My partner was on the legislature at the time, Richard DiLiberto, and was, I believe, a... I don't know if he was part of that or not. I should know the answer to that question, but I don't.
Well, is there any support for the proposition that the offer of judgment should be viewed as $2.5 million?
No, none whatsoever. In order to put a written settlement demand together to these two defendants, these cases were actually filed originally as separate actions, and there's a potential that either one of them would not have been liable at all. There are arguments that are just materially different. They may not be joint and severally and individually liable. So in putting together these kinds of settlement demands, all that the plaintiff really can do is estimate what the damages are and ask that the person who would ultimately be responsible in paying for it to give them an opportunity to pay it. And the only way this can be done is really to determine what the damages are, and then separately send your settlement proposals out to the individual defendants who may, in fact, share a common liability or may not share a common liability. That's what was done in this case. Under Rule 68, we thought the decisions, particularly the Cahill decision most recently by this court, was helpful because it affirmed the several Superior Court cases which have considered this issue under the Rule 68 offers of judgment. And the indication there was that you needed to individualize the settlement offers of judgment to the plaintiff so that the court later can determine by, you know, reading the rule, did they comply or did they not comply. And in this case, that same logic applies. The statute is very clear. I mean, the General Assembly can be admonished for poor draftsmanship on occasion, but this is one time they shouldn't. This statute is clear, it's precise, it's written in words that...
Well, it doesn't say anything about joint tortfeasors.
But it does not have to, because by using defendant in the singular, and it uses plaintiff in the singular, but by using defendant in the singular, it's expressing an intention to end a litigation by settlement against a party, mainly a tortfeasor. The same purposes that are served by making a settlement demand to a single defendant is, in a case with a single defendant, is the same when you have multiple defendants. What you're trying to do is to end the litigation as to that defendant, that party. And that's what separate written settlement demands accomplish. I should note in this case that the reality of it all is that when I've never had a case, and I've had many cases where you make a settlement demand to a defendant for something that's not a policy limits case, you never get a check for $1,250,000 from the defendant. It's an effort to negotiate with an amount that you believe represents fair compensation for the claim, and then you begin to negotiate. In this case, both defendants had a no settlement under any circumstances posture in the case. So we say the statute is clear, unambiguous. The court was required under the rules of statutory construction, most recently enunciated by this court in Leatherbury versus Greenspan, the most important of which is unambiguous statutes are not subject to judicial interpretation. And that if the statute as a whole is unambiguous and there is no reasonable doubt as to the meaning of the words used, the court's role is limited to an application of the literal meaning of those words. In this case, there were arguments made on appeal that were not made below, but if Your Honor is going to consider them under the plain error standard, even though this is an error of law and Your Honors have de novo review, I would like to mention that the hospital's position that somehow the medical negligence is not a tort. It's just untenable. A farmer can call his mule a horse until he's blue in the face, and at the end of the day, that mule's still going to be a horse. And tortious misconduct by a healthcare provider, called by any other name, is still a tort. This statute...
At the end of the day, the mule's still going to be a mule.
Well, that is true. And at the end of the day, although the healthcare provider will still be a healthcare provider, his conduct will still be tortious, and will be tortious for purpose of 2301D.
I know, Mr. Tappa, that all of the arguments you've made thus far rest on the premise that the happy result of this case will be that your judgment is affirmed, but your opponents are doing their level best to make sure that doesn't happen. Why don't we address arguments.
Very well, Your Honor, and I do want to address them. I must say that, first of all, that it is discretionary for the court to, and we know that the treatises are very clear about this, that there is great latitude and discretion given to the trial judge to determine the mode in which a witness will be examined at trial.
And what's the leading authority that would support the proposition that the trial judge can declare throughout the trial all expert witnesses will be allowed to be examined by leading questions?
Your Honors, on that question, I agree that it would be arguably an abuse of discretion for the court to give a blank check to counsel to interrogate an expert witness by leading questions. And I think if you read the transcript, there's my comment to the court is somewhat, well, Your Honor, I not necessarily agree with your ruling, even though it would benefit me since I'm interrogating an expert witness at the time. And what happened after that ruling was issued, I certainly did not, I challenge the defense to actually show that there are that many leading questions. I've been interrogating witnesses for over 30 years, many doctors. I haven't changed my method of direct examination ever. And I, if we use Nurse Hirsch, for example, as one example.
Well, let's parse where we're going with this first.
Sure.
And the first question is, what was the Superior Court's ruling, and is it correct as a matter of law or exercise of discretion? Where you seem to be heading with the rest of your answer is, notwithstanding the fact that a broad ruling might not have been proper, I didn't take advantage of the ruling anyway, because if you look at the record, you'll see there weren't that many leading questions.
And there was no prejudice, but you're
right,
correct,
so
Your Honor.
Start at the beginning on what the law should be or how discretion should be exercised properly.
I do believe, I have found no authority that allows the court to simply say, you can interrogate every expert witness by leading questions in direct examination. So I have to say I don't believe that I can argue that, and I haven't argued it. So I do believe it is more likely than not going to be an abuse of discretion for a trial judge to issue such a ruling.
Well, did you explain that to the trial judge? I thought at one point he said he wanted to go back and check to make sure he was right.
Interestingly, Your Honor, he did, and he came back and with authorities and explanations both that are on the record of the trial transcript and to some lesser extent, but I think significantly similar on his post-trial order. And what he said was, you know, expert witnesses in medical malpractice cases deal with complex issues, and I'm going to allow it for a whole lot of reasons. And some of those reasons were to develop the testimony, that the witness is not subject to being manipulated because he's a professional witness. But at the same time, a narrative answer is sometimes less desirable because you've got a doctor up there and they don't know when to stop talking. So there is some encouragement to lead so that the issues are honed in on what's relevant in the case. So he gave a lot of explanations for why he felt, under the circumstances, he could permit leading questions of expert. I'm not so sure that it's that clear that he intended me to be able to ask every question. Isn't it true, doctor? Isn't it true, nurse? I don't think he intended that.
Mr. Ferry tells us that at some point in the trial, he said, the leading questions are recurring. I'd like to have a standing objection. And the court agreed. Is that correct?
That is correct. And I dispute the fact that the questions were that leading. The court acknowledged that the questions that were being singled out as leading were barely leading.
Well, what is that? I mean, it's either leading or it's not, isn't it?
Well, that is true to some extent, but not really, because when you ask a witness a leading question, the more you stick into the question and you're asking the witness to affirm, you know, that. And it's something that really is coming from the interrogator and not from the witness. Yeah, that's leading. But when you're referring in a question substantive information that is undisputed in the record, not contested by anybody, previously disclosed by the witness, simply making reference to other documents in the case or testimony, it's leading only because the answer is suggested by a question. But there are gradations. Wow. There's a big difference between asking a witness, is it true or not that, and giving them an option to answer and pick one or the other.
I always understood that a leading question, at least in form, is one that would be answered yes or no. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is your classic leading question.
What would a barely leading question be?
Well, it might be, was the light red or green? Now, we know that's leading. You're suggesting the color of the light. Maybe it was yellow. But in reality, you're asking the witness to choose between two obviously relevant matters that nobody's really going to dispute in the case. So, yes, it's leading, Your Honor. But is it impermissible?
Well, help us understand why there's a greater need to lead an expert. It would seem intuitively that an expert would need less help getting to an answer. They've already given a report, they've rendered an opinion, and you would simply get them to elaborate. And it would seem that you would rather have the expert elaborate on their opinion than simply answer yes or no questions.
I agree. And if you read the record, or if this record is read, there aren't that many leading questions. I didn't ask leading questions in the manner that's being suggested by the hospital. It just didn't happen that way.
All right, well then let's go back and tell me your characterization of the record and maybe where we can find it. But I thought in response to my earlier question that you agreed that the judge made a ruling that leading questions would be permitted on a continuing basis. Mr. Ferry asked for a standing objection to leading questions, and then the trial proceeded.
That is correct. And I don't dispute that. And I didn't accept the court's ruling. And I didn't follow the court's ruling. And if the record is looked at, for example, Nurse Hirsch, the first witness, I went back and I looked and to see how many questions were leading of Nurse Hirsch. And, you know, I don't know how many total questions there were, but it wasn't that long a direct, more than 60 questions. The questions were what, where, when, and why.
All right, well, then go back to the questions we asked Mr. Ferry. At the end of the day, we said to him, tell us how you were prejudiced. And as I understand your argument, it is, even if we conclude the judge's broad-based ruling that leading questions were permissible might have been an error, but it was a harmless error because you didn't take advantage of the ruling.
That is precisely correct. And I believe it's borne out by the testimony when it's looked at objectively, and also by the reality that the defense had the opportunity to cross-examine and recross on points. They had the opportunity of pretrial disclosure, both in written disclosure statements and in depositions that they took, where every issue discussed at the trial was going into in great detail. They had witnesses lined up to come in and testify. They didn't call half of them. You know why? Because they didn't materially disagree with the opinions of the plaintiff's experts. They had a nurse expert, for example. She never testified. The hospital
could have called. I was a little slow starting the clock. You have about a minute left before we get to the time you reserved.
Very well, Your Honor. So we say, Your Honor, that the leading questions, well, I don't necessarily subscribe to the rule of the trial court in this case. It was not abused by certainly me, and it was in the final analysis, no, there was no prejudice at all to the defendant hospital in this case. They had ample opportunity to recross the witnesses, and they had other witnesses they called and did go into all of these issues as well. I guess I should hit some of the other issues that have an impact on this appeal. For example, I join in with Mr. Elzafan on the question about his comments about the truth. Everybody who's had a case with Mr. Elzafan knows he's a zealous and passionate arguer for his client's behalf. But he explained to the jury that he wasn't there to say who was telling the truth or not. The jury instructions covered that as well. So we don't see any error with respect to his comments at all. As to Mr. Elzafan's client, Dr. Connor, argument about the causation issue opinion of Dr. Polin, first of all, the only basis that there was for objection dealt with a 403 objection that this information should be looked at in view of the fact that it could confuse the jury because it might look like it's a standard of care comment by the particular witness. And we say that this doesn't hold up. The trial court did a proper Rule 403 analysis. The trial court determined that the testimony was highly probative on a causation issue that had been disclosed before the trial.
It was disclosed before the trial that Dr. Polin would testify. The testimony was ordered at 10 o'clock rather than 11:15.
Dr. Polin didn't say that. He said his testimony, his opinion before the trial was that if the CT scan had been ordered stat by 11:30, that things would have gone forward in a way that would have led to an earlier surgery and hence a favorable outcome. All that this doctor did was explain that if it had been done earlier than 11:30, which is consistent with him saying by 11:30 that indeed it would have been a favorable outcome for Mr. Harris.
Couldn't that have created an impression in the jury's mind that Dr. Connor should have ordered the stat CT scan at 10 o'clock in the morning or later?
Absolutely not, for at least three reasons. One, the two standard of care experts that I called both testified that the standard of care did not require Dr. Connor to do it earlier, that she had to do it by 11:15 or 11:30, their testimony was. However, they both testified with no objection from defendants' counsel in this case, that the standard of care was a time period that began around 9:30 and ended about 11:30 when the CT scan had to be ordered stat. It wasn't that it had to be ordered at 9:30 or it had to be ordered at 11:30, but it had to be ordered within that time period. The reason that further explanation was being solicited from Dr. Poulton was so the jury would not be confused and think that, oh, geez, what if they, if it had been done at 10 o'clock, would he have been saved? So, sir. Thank you very much.
I believe I just have a few seconds.
You can have 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to answer Judge Ridgely's question and direct Your Honor to pages 25, 26, 28 of our opening brief, which we laid out question and answer, which would, I believe, answer your question about false memory. And
So what I was looking for is something that indicates it was not otherwise supported by the record, deposition, or report prior to that time.
I don't know if that would meet that criteria as you just suggested it. What I thought you had meant was where the summarization in the question lays out all the facts so that the witness doesn't have to recall anything or even prove that she or he actually reviewed the chart in question. That's what I thought you meant by false memory. Apparently, but I will look for the other as well. My comment with regard to the leading question is when it's so permissible as it was in this case, the person whose the objection tool is taken away from has no idea and can't tell the court if the court had sustained that objection, what that witness would have said, and how that witness's credibility would have been evaluated by a jury under those circumstances. And that's why it is so different in this case as opposed to even the cases that were cited in the court's opinion about discretion when you ask experts' opinions. In this case, it was so pervasive that you almost have to come to the conclusion that there had to be some prejudice if leading questions could be asked of every expert across the board, including friendly witnesses who that attorney prepared already, and as I believe Justice Holland asked or mentioned, they would presumably know what their opinions are going to be and not need leading questions.
Your position is that if you're correct and the ruling on a standing authorization for leading questions was incorrect, that ruling pervaded your ability to conduct the rest of your case.
That's correct, Your Honor, because it takes away from me the tool of objecting, and I have that duty to my client to do that, but I couldn't do it in this case because if an expert was on the stand and I stood up and said I object to leading, I would be told over and over again it's an expert, and pretty soon the jury would think I just not getting the message, and I think that would be prejudicial.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Who would like to speak next?
Your Honor, I think we've all used our 20 minutes.
I was not provided with any rebuttal, and I used my 20 minutes.
Very good. Thank you very much. The court appreciates your briefing and your oral arguments in this case. I will take the matter under advisement, and we'll also take a brief recess.